Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mary, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Caring for Your Bones When You Have Breast Cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. And we have on the call today over 957 participants. So it's really amazing that you're all on this call today. And you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and states in the United States. And we also have a number of international participants from Canada, Korea, Mexico, Syria, Thailand, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call, and we're delighted that you're all with us. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is an outline that our speakers have prepared, and there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations as resources for each of you. These are resources that you can contact and get additional help from. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of the program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can really best tell us the different programs and services that we could offer and the topics that you're most interested in hearing about. Indeed, today's workshop is one that many of you have asked us to do on a number of occasions, and so we're offering it today. So we very much listen to what you say and take to heart what you say. Now, this activity today is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Julie Grallo. Grallo is a professor of medical oncology, director of breast medical oncology, University of Washington School of Medicine, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, member of Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And Dr. Grallo is going to address overview of breast cancer, bone loss and bone metastases, screening for bone health and risk factors, prescription medication to promote bone health, and doctor-patient communication. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Grallo.
Great. Well, thanks, Carolyn, and welcome to everybody who's listening in on this call. There's lots of interaction between breast cancer and the bone, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. The three main areas where we talk about bone and breast cancer interactions are, first of all, looking at bone health, bone loss, or osteoporosis. We know that breast cancer patients are at increased risk for bone loss and osteoporosis. We also talk about treating bone metastases. Bone metastases can occur, and when a metastatic recurrence has happened, are common in breast cancer patients. And then the third area would be, is there a role in preventing recurrences, bone recurrences in particular, in breast cancer patients? So I'm going to touch on the first two of those areas. And why don't we start with the issue of preserving bone mineral density and preventing bone loss. Why is this so important? Well, the fact is that 44 million American men and women have low bone density and osteoporosis, and that women who undergo treatment for breast cancer are at a greater risk than the average woman. Bone loss is a normal consequence of aging, and our peak bone mineral density occurs when we're about 20 to 25, and then gradually over time, it's just a normal aging process that we lose some bone mineral density with age, whether we're male or female. Why do we care about bone density and osteoporosis? It's because when our bones get less dense, they become more brittle and they're more prone to fracture. And so osteoporosis, which is a state of low bone density, is a major risk factor for fractures. And in particular, we care about fractures of the spine and the hip because that can be what causes the most problem. So it's a fact that more than 40% of U.S. women are going to experience an osteoporotic bone fracture by the time they're 70, and that osteoporosis results in about 350,000 hip fractures each year in the U.S. That's expected to increase as our population age increases. And hip fractures are a big problem. Some of you on the call may have had a hip fracture. Many of us have had relatives with a hip fracture. They can cause long-lasting disabilities and problems. So we want to avoid those. What are the main risk factors for bone loss and osteoporosis? Well, being tall and thin. Lots of people think in many ways those could be good things, but they can be risk factors for osteoporosis. Just being Caucasian is a risk factor for osteoporosis, and getting older, smoking, actually needing thyroid hormone replacement is a risk factor. Low physical activity is a risk factor, and early menopause. And so that leads into what are the reasons that women with breast cancer can have accelerated bone loss and higher risk for osteoporosis. A big part of that is because, one, in younger women, chemotherapy can induce an early menopause, and that loss of estrogen increases osteoporosis. And we also use ovarian suppression as a treatment sometimes, so we're shutting down estrogen. In postmenopausal women, being on aromatase inhibitors, which further removes every last bit of estrogen in our body, essentially, can speed up bone loss and increase osteoporosis. A normal postmenopausal woman will have about a 2% per year rate of bone loss. That's kind of the naturally occurring bone loss. And if you're a postmenopausal woman on an aromatase inhibitor for treatment of your breast cancer, that might go all the way up to 3% per year. And if you're a young woman who's had a chemotherapy-induced menopause, in that first year after your ovaries are shut down from your treatment, you could lose 7 to 8% of your bone mineral density in just 1 year. So it's a problem for women with breast cancer, and our treatments exacerbate it. How do we measure bone loss, and how do we evaluate it? Well, lots of you have probably heard of a DEXA scan. It's a scan that can measure bone density, and a common way to do a DEXA scan is to look at your spine and to look at your hip, and we get reported numbers from that. We get absolute values for bone density. We can get something called a Z-score, which is comparing your bone's density to other women of your age. And what we most commonly use in looking at bone health and osteoporosis is the T-score. And that is comparing our own bone density to that of peak bone mineral density. So we'd be comparing to a population of young women who are 20 to 25 years. And so some of you may know what your T-scores are. If they're in the negative range, that means you have less bone density than an average 25-year-old. And if they're positive, that means your bones are denser than an average 25-year-old. What are some of the interventions we can do, whether we have breast cancer or not, in decreasing our risk of osteoporosis and bone loss? Well, both Dr. Rugo and Dr. Schwartz are going to talk more about this, but I'll just throw out so you can anticipate hearing more about this. We need adequate intake of calcium and vitamin D. We can increase physical activity to help with decreasing our risk of osteoporosis. We can eliminate tobacco, decrease caffeine and alcohol, prevent falls. Most fractures, especially of the hip, happen with a fall. And we can follow bone density and react to it. And then, so what are some drug therapies or pharmacologic interventions? Well, estrogen is actually good for the bones, but for most breast cancer patients, it's not an option. The most common treatments for osteoporosis are in the class that we call bisphosphonates, and those can include abandronate, which is Boniva, alendronate, which is Fosamax, resedronate, which is Actonel, and zoledronic acid, which is reclast. And the most recent drug that's been approved for osteoporosis is in a new class called RANK ligand inhibitors. And the drug in that class that was approved for osteoporosis recently is called denosumab or Prolia. And that, instead of being a pill, is a subcutaneous injection underneath the skin that you get every 6 months. There are a few other options for drug therapy, but generally the bisphosphonates and now the RANK ligand inhibitor Prolia are most commonly used. And so with that, I'll move just really briefly for a few minutes in breast cancer in the bones and treating bone metastases. So there's a very well-studied interaction between breast cancer cells and the bone. And when breast cancer cells travel through the bone marrow, they can send out signals to the bone cells, the osteoclasts that chew up bone, and they say, destroy some bone, create a space for me. And then as the bone is being resorbed or broken down, then that can send signals to the breast cancer cells to grow and divide. So we get what we call this vicious cycle set up, where the breast cancer cells feed the cells that break down bone, and the cells that break down bone feed the breast cancer cells. And so we need to disrupt that interaction when we have bone metastases. Bone is the first site of recurrence in about 35 to 40% of patients who have a recurrence. And ultimately, if you've had a recurrence of your breast cancer, the rate of bone metastases can approach 80%. So it's common for breast cancer, if it comes back, to come back in the bone. Back in the quote-unquote old days, when we didn't have good therapies that kind of affected this interaction between the breast cancer and the bone, we had really high rates of what we call skeletal-related events. And skeletal-related events would be fractures due to the cancer being in the bone, or the need for radiation therapy to the bone, or surgery to the bone, or even something called a spinal cord compression, where our vertebral column would collapse and push against the spinal cord. And before we started routinely giving breast cancer patients who have obvious bone metastases drugs that helped strengthen the bones, in 2 years we would have almost two-thirds of patients with breast cancer and bone metastases would have one of these skeletal-related events, most commonly a fracture. So there are things we can do to help with bone metastases and breast cancer. We can treat the pain. We can do surgeries and radiation. And we can add these drugs that interfere with the relationship between the breast cancer and the bone. And again, they're the same drugs that can help treat osteoporosis, the bisphosphonates and the RANK ligand inhibitors. And we have good studies where we've checked patients who have bone metastases and either randomized them to a placebo or a bisphosphonate or now one of these RANK ligand inhibitors, and we've decreased the skeletal-related events significantly. So that's good news, and it's now routine that if we see bone metastases, we prescribe zoledronic acid or pimidronate or denosumab, one of these drugs that prevents bone breakdown. And they can also, in addition to preventing skeletal-related events, they can help with pain. So with that, I think my time is up, and I've given an overview of bone health, osteoporosis, and also bone mets, talked a little bit about some of the drugs that we can use in both of those situations. And I would just really encourage all of you, if you're dealing with the osteoporosis and bone loss issues, or if you're facing treating bone metastases, to talk about a lot of these things that I've brought up and that you'll hear about in the next few minutes with your healthcare team, because that's going to be the best way to get the best outcome. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grelo, for just a wonderful presentation, for really setting the stage for the program today, but also for making people understand how important it is, this area, and all the things that can be done that are helpful to everyone. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and thank you so much. We're going to go on to Dr. Anna Schwartz. And Dr. Anna Schwartz is affiliate professor, University of Washington, nurse practitioner, St. John's Medical Center. And and Dr. Schwartz is actually going to address cover an overview of the role of exercise and activity and lifestyle modifications and weight management. Dr. Schwartz?
Participate in this exciting discussion today. We should think of exercise as a healing medicine, not a bitter pill, but a whole body positive, life-enhancing and energy-restoring sort of medicine. Drs. Grelo and soon-to-be-heard Dr. Rugo are providing a wonderful overview of bone health issues and about the specific clinical guidelines to help preserve your bone health. But those guidelines primarily focus on pharmacologic treatment using some of the different drugs that Dr. Grelo just spoke about and using calcium and vitamin D. Typically, women do not receive recommendations or instructions on exercise to preserve body composition, and certainly most women don't get specific guidance about exercise. Even though we know that exercise improves bone density, muscle mass, and helps us to maintain our body weights. Exercise programs that are specific to improving or maintaining bone health and body composition are different from the general exercise recommendations to improve health and reduce chronic disease risk. The American College of Sports Medicine provides specific evidence-based recommendations for exercise to promote bone health across the lifespan. The recommendation for preserving bone health in adulthood calls for weight-bearing endurance exercises like walking with intermittent jogging and impact or resistance exercise at a moderate to high intensity. Specifically, a woman should strive to perform endurance exercise 3 to 5 days a week and ideally do impact or resistance exercise 2 to 3 days a week. And the exercise session should be 30 to 60 minutes long. But in reality, many women need to build up to this. Start out too quickly or exercise for too long, and you'll feel terrible and never want to go back to it. Remember, exercise does not have to be painful or unpleasant. As a matter of fact, gardening is one of the best activities to improve bone health because you do a lot of bending, stretching, twisting, and lifting, all of which put torque on your hips and spine to trigger good bone growth. So choose activities you like to do. Start slowly and progress slowly. Set realistic goals and take small steps to achieve them. While we don't know if there's one exercise that is better or more effective at stimulating bone growth, we do know that impact and resistance exercise is important to improving bone health. A study that I recently completed compared 120 women who were just starting chemotherapy for breast cancer and were assigned to moderate intensity aerobic exercise, resistance, or usual care. We expected that the resistance exercise group would have better bone health, but boy, were we wrong. The resistance exercises lifted weights got bored with the exercise and stopped doing it. So the aerobic exercise group turned out to have statistically better bone density, bone preservation, and muscle mass after 6 months than the women in the resistance exercise or usual care group. Usual care group means that those women did nothing other than what they'd usually do. They didn't get special exercise. The women who walked showed a minimal decline in their bone density, about a 1% loss, compared to the resistance exercisers who lost nearly 5% of their bone density and the usual care group who lost nearly 7% of their bone density. An additional benefit is that the walkers maintain their body weight and increase their muscle mass. These improvements are astounding when you think that these women simply walked every other day. Another study out of Yale University observed similar results. Women who were at least 6 months beyond treatment for breast cancer who walked briskly 5 days a week were observed to maintain their bone mineral density compared to usual care subjects. And a third study of postmenopausal breast cancer survivors who were 1 year beyond treatment compared the effects of resistance plus impact exercise. So what that really means is lifting weights and jumping with a weighted vest on to a stretching control group. This study found that lifting weights and jumping improved bone density and prevented bone loss. While the study shows promise, I'm really not sure how many women will actually start jumping around with weights. Exercise needs to be something we can incorporate into our daily lives in a simple and efficient way. That's why we see the benefits of brisk walking. It's an easy activity to do alone, with your dog, or with friends. Changes in body composition, such as weight gain, during and after cancer treatment are common. What is important to remember is that you can do something about it. It takes patience, persistence, and determination to set realistic goals. You don't have to start running marathons or set world records to improve your body composition. You just have to be consistent in your quest to change your exercise, diet, and lifestyle. All breast cancer survivors should exercise because a physically active lifestyle has multiple health benefits, including reducing the risk for falls and improving physical and emotional aspects of health. Exercise is safe. It's a non-pharmacologic strategy to improve your bone health, increase muscle strength, and maintain body weight during and following cancer treatment. Exercise is a good medicine that will improve many other aspects of life and help to not only control your weight and reduce your risks for recurrence, but also reduce your risks for other chronic diseases like heart disease and diabetes. Exercise can help you survive and thrive and help you to feel a real intensity and passion for life. I hope the information I have shared with you will inspire you to begin an exercise program to not only strengthen your bones and body and heal your soul, but also to help you realize your potential to live life to the fullest. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Anna, for just an excellent presentation. Dr. Schwartz, that's just really excellent, very informative. It's an area that everyone is always very concerned about and is often wondering, you know, what to do about that. And so I very much appreciate, you know, your excellent presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. We are having some difficulty with Dr. Arrugo's line, and so at this point I'm going to bring back Dr. Grelo. And Dr. Grelo has graciously will cover the concepts of clinical trials, the role of nutrition, calcium, and vitamin D supplements, controlling pain and discomfort, and quality of life concerns. I now turn the program over to Dr. Grelo.
Thanks, Carolyn, and I'm sorry we couldn't get Dr. Arrugo on. I know she was on earlier. The third area that I didn't cover when I talked about this interaction between breast cancer and bone was this concept of actually knowing that there is this interesting interaction when breast cancer first gets into the bone. Can we interfere with that and prevent bone metastases and other metastases from developing at all? So I'll talk about that just a little bit, and then I'll move into the nutrition, calcium, vitamin D, and the controlling the pain. So there's been a couple of studies that have looked at newly diagnosed breast cancer patients who don't have evidence of recurrent or metastatic disease. And at the time of their diagnosis, when they're getting all their other treatments, their surgery, their radiation, their chemotherapy, endocrine therapy, these trials have looked at randomizing to, again, one of these anti-bone drugs, one of the drugs that prevents bone breakdown, either a bisphosphonate, and zoledronic acid has been studied here, also another bisphosphonate, not approved in the U.S., but approved to treat bone metastases in other countries, Quadrinate. Also, we're starting to study denosumab, this RAN ligand inhibitor. So the first studies that were done of early-stage breast cancer patients randomized to get a bisphosphonate or not for anywhere from 2 to 5 years, depending on the study we're talking about. The first studies were with Quadrinate. This is an oral bisphosphonate, and it's given orally daily. And there were 3 trials done in Europe, which is where this drug is approved. And 2 of the 3 trials actually showed what we call a survival benefit, meaning that less women died in the group that got the Quadrinate versus the group that got a placebo or that didn't get Quadrinate. And so we scratched our heads and said, was this because we were preventing bone metastases and therefore we were preventing subsequent metastases that might have traveled to other places? Why was this happening? We talked to the FDA about whether we could get Quadrinate approved in this setting, and they said, you need to do another big trial. Do it in North America with Quadrinate before we'll believe the data, before we'll get it approved in the U.S. for this purpose. And indeed, that trial is going to report in just a couple months, in December. So it's already on the agenda. We don't have the results yet, but we're going to see the report of that big trial called the NSABP B34 trial, and that will report in December. So we're going to have to keep our eyes open for that one. Again, it was stage 1 and 2 breast cancer patients. They got all standard treatment and were randomized to a couple of years of Quadrinate versus placebo. So in the U.S., we also took a look at a more potent bisphosphonate that we use more typically to treat bone metastases, zoledronic acid, and a couple trials have reported now on that. One is called the Austrian Breast Cancer Study Group 12 trial, and then we've got more recently a trial called the Azure trial. So these were trials where, again, our early-stage breast cancer patients, no evidence of distant or metastatic disease, and they got standard treatment, and then they were randomized to get zoledronic acid or not. And the first trial to report was the Austrian Breast Cancer Study Group 12 trial, and this was premenopausal women who had estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer, and they got endocrine therapy that shut down their ovaries, and then they were randomized to tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. And as a second part of the study, they were randomized to get zoledronic acid, just one dose intravenously every 6 months or not. And that study has been presented. We saw recent 5-year follow-up results from it, and that study showed less recurrences in the group that got zoledronic acid every 6 months for 3 years added to their endocrine treatment. And that was a really important result, but it was a limited population of breast cancer patients. Remember, they were premenopausal, their tumors were estrogen receptor positive, and they were all getting endocrine therapy, and almost none of them got chemotherapy. So it didn't necessarily apply to most of the breast cancer patients being diagnosed out there, but it was really important for the subset that met the criteria for the trial. So more recently, we've seen the results from a trial called the Azure trial. And that we don't have as much data on to date, but it reported last December. We're still all trying to understand the results of it. It was a trial that was really done mostly in Europe, and it was led by the UK. It was a trial of early-stage breast cancer patients getting standard treatment, and they were randomized to zoledronic acid versus control. And the zoledronic acid was given in a much more intense way than it was given in that other trial, the Austrian trial. It was given monthly for 6 months, which is more the way that we give it to treat bone mets, and then they backed off after 6 months. Then they went to every 3 months and then every 6 months. And patients got this drug for a total of 5 years. So what we saw last December was that overall, it was a negative trial. There was no benefit in terms of reducing recurrences or extending survival for adding zoledronic acid. But in a subset analysis where we tried to figure out was there a population who might be benefiting, there's a hint that postmenopausal women might be benefiting from the addition of zoledronic acid. So that leaves a lot of questions. And it means that we have more work to be done. It is not routine standard of care that we should add zoledronic acid for preventing bone metastases at this point in time. But we have several other trials that we'll report soon that will help us better decide if this should be a strategy and which patients, because not all patients are at risk for recurrence or recurrence in the bones, and maybe it's only a subset of our breast cancer patients who would benefit. So some food for thought there, a very exciting area, but not really yet ready for prime time. Stay tuned. So what about moving on now to the role of nutrition, calcium, and vitamin D supplements in maintaining bone health? I kind of referred to that in my talk when I was talking about bone loss and osteoporosis, but let's talk about it just a little bit more. It's really critical that we get adequate intake of calcium and vitamin D and indeed even protein. And yet the recommendations for how much calcium and how much vitamin D we should take have been a moving target. They're moving all around. I found a really good website that can talk about calcium and vitamin D and all other supplements is the National Institute of Health's Office of Dietary Supplements. And if you just type that into Google, if you're a web person, the National Institute of Health or NIH, Office of Dietary Supplements, you'll get a page where you can access fact sheets on all kinds of vitamins and supplements. And it gives you kind of the background behind the recommendations and reasonable recommendations. So for calcium, which that's most of what our bones are composed of, it's important that we get it either in our diet, and some women eat a very reasonable diet that has a lot of calcium in it, but most American women anyway probably don't get enough calcium in their diet. And so we would generally recommend, especially if you have a low estrogen state, you're postmenopausal, that you take somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 milligrams a day. And with vitamin D, most of our vitamin D is made through sunlight and through our skin. So if we live in parts of the world where we get a lot of sun exposure and we don't use a lot of suntan lotion, which actually will block the development of vitamin D, then maybe we don't need as much in our diet and we don't need to take supplements. But for again, I live up in Seattle. This time of year, we're not getting a whole lot of sunlight. So most women in Seattle will need a vitamin D supplement, and that also is a moving target. Maybe somewhere, depending on what you get in your diet, between 400 and 800 international units a day. But that's going to vary depending on sunlight and what you get in your diet. And again, go to that NIH Office of Dietary Supplements. They have a lot of information about vitamin D. Now, Dr. Schwartz has talked about the benefits of physical activity and all kinds of different physical activity on helping with bone loss. And I've also previously mentioned, but I'll reinforce, that tobacco, smoking, is not good for your bone density. It's interesting that we've got some studies, and the evidence might be a little weaker here, that caffeine and maybe even alcohol can decrease our bone density or not be good for building our bones again. So take a look at what you're doing there, too. So last, controlling pain and discomfort and quality of life concerns, we're kind of bouncing back to maybe the presence of bone metastases and pain that might come from having cancer that's breaking down the bones. And it's really important that you talk to your healthcare team about this. It's true that the drugs that can help reduce skeletal-related events in the setting of bone metastases, like zoledronic acid, like denosumab, can also help reduce pain from the bone metastases. Also, radiation therapy can sometimes help with the pain. And analgesics, what we really want to avoid is needing a lot of opiates and drugs that cause a lot of sedation, but sometimes that's needed too. But the key here is that we do have some drugs and we do have some treatments that can help reduce pain due to bone metastases, but the best treatment is going to be one that you come up with in conjunction with your healthcare team and talking with them about what kind of pain you're experiencing and what kind of impact on your quality of life, either osteoporosis and a fracture or maybe a fracture due to a bone metastasis is causing. So that was a quick overview of several topics, and hopefully it's given you some food for thought to kind of empower you, give you some ideas for questions that you might want to ask of your healthcare team. And I'll thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grayla. Wonderful presentation, really covering these very important issues for everyone, and I know there'll be more questions during the Q&A as well. And it's now my pleasure to introduce Patricia Spicer, who actually is the breast cancer program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Pat is going to review the free psychosocial support services that you can access from Cancer Care, as well as the role of breast cancer support groups. Pat?
Oh, thank
Pat
you, Carol.
Is an oncology social worker. I'm sorry. Pat is also an oncology social worker.
I just like to remind you all before we start that this year is the 25th anniversary of the founding of Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So congratulations to all of you who are survivors and consider yourself a survivor no matter where you are on the treatment spectrum. Particularly for women who were dealing with metastatic disease, a support group can be a wonderful source of adding to the quality of their lives. The thoughts and feelings that you might have that you're hesitant to express to your family or to your friends, breast cancer support groups provide a wonderful venue for this. The women who were in the group or the men who were in the group with you, and I have had men in my group, understand exactly what your thoughts and feelings are and the issues that you are dealing with. They provide not only emotional support, but very real coping skills and have been very efficient at developing methods of dealing with the changes in their lives that occur as the result of having to deal with metastatic disease. So I'd like you to consider if you are dealing with bone mets or any other kind of metastatic breast cancer that you consider looking for a breast cancer support group in your area. If there is no one available locally, Cancer Care supplies support groups in both an online, face-to-face, and telephone format, as well as individual counseling and financial support for women who have help, who need help dealing with the cost of their medications. To contact us, you can reach us online at www.cancercare.org. or our toll-free line, which is 1-800-813-4673. Please don't hesitate to call. We'd like to be of help or to answer your questions or concerns. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your presentation. It's really excellent. And also just really highlighting the importance of getting support and help during this experience. So I think that's really excellent. Thank you. And now I'll thank all of our speakers. And now we have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. And I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board. And we're going to try to take as many questions as we can. I want to encourage all of you to go ahead and queue up and ask your questions, and we'll start taking questions. Mary, could you explain to everyone how to do that, how to queue up?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit your questions by clicking ask a question. Our first question comes from Shirley M.
Hello. Thank you for this wonderful presentation. I would like to ask a question on behalf of metastatic patients who have been on long-term use of zoledronic acid. I believe Dr. Grelo pointed out that normally the standard treatment is to receive that infusion every 4 weeks. When one has been on that a number of years, is it appropriate to lengthen or space out, I should say, the infusion of zoledronic acid, say, to 6 weeks or 9 weeks or 12 weeks? I heard one presentation by a doctor in New York, a dentist who treated people with necrosis of the jaw, who said that that zoledronic acid really only acts when it is infused. Even though it has a long half-life, the action on the bone really comes at the time of infusion. So I guess my concern is lengthening out the infusions less helpful than if they were done every 4 weeks? And thank you for your answer.
Okay, well, thank you for that question. Dr. Grelo?
So this is a great question. Thanks, Shirley. So with respect to the issue of how does the zoledronic acid work, is it only working as it's infusing, it works by being taken up by the bone and laid down in the bone. So if the bone is very active, if the cancer is causing a lot of breakdown, the zoledronic acid will get taken up into the bone, and it will stay there indefinitely for years once it's taken up. And if the bone is really quiet, then not much gets taken up. So the fact of the matter is that the interval at which we give the zoledronic acid probably ultimately would be best if we could tailor it to what's going on in your bones at a given time. If the cancer's pretty well controlled by the other treatments, then maybe we could go out to long intervals. If it's really active right now and we're getting more bone mets or they're growing, then maybe you would even potentially shorten it. So there are a couple of trials going on right now looking at, after you've had about a year or more of treatment, going to every 3-month infusions instead of monthly. And we just don't have the data from those yet. There's also some interest in, after you've had a lot of zoledronic acid, maybe we should consider switching to denosumab for bone health reasons, because it, as an antibody, doesn't get laid down in the bones indefinitely and might have different long-term impact, you know, if you're going to stay on a drug for years and years. So it's a terrific question. We don't really know the right answer. I'd say that because breast cancer patients with bone mets can live a long time, you know, years and years, if not, you know, decades, that we really need to address this question. And in practice, I think we are starting to extend the interval after patients have been on the drug, but it's not because we have solid scientific evidence to support it.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Denise Kay.
Hi, thank you. My question was the same as the first question, and so I'll just say thank you for this very good program.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Yolanta G.
Hello. My question is around osteopenia rather than osteoporosis, and what is your recommendation regarding treatment for that?
And we actually have Dr. Rugo on the call now, so I'm going to ask Dr. Rugo if she would address that question.
You're asking what the treatment for osteopenia rather than osteoporosis is, and it's, I have to say, you know, relatively controversial. If a patient has osteopenia, the risk for fracture is not anywhere near as high as if you meet the criteria for osteoporosis. But I think it's important to remember that it's not that you suddenly leap into a new category when you get to osteoporosis. It's a continuous line of bone loss. And when you're osteoporotic, when you reach a certain amount of bone loss, your risk of fracture is higher. So you treat based on that understanding, that the reason why you're treating osteopenia and osteoporosis is to try and prevent fracture. So when patients have osteopenia, it can be a big range of T-scores, these scores that come up on the bone mineral density that Dr. Grela discussed. So if you've got mild osteopenia and you're not taking any medications that make your bone loss worse, and you're not just about to go into sudden menopause at the age of 38, then you use all the methods you've been hearing about on the call today, calcium, vitamin D, exercise, and the dietary issues also that Dr. Grelo mentioned. And then if you have, though, a significant osteopenia and you're maybe going to go on an aromatase inhibitor and have your ovaries suppressed, then you might want to intervene with an oral or IV subcutaneous agent earlier, the drugs you heard about. And that's really, I think, how we all deal with this.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Rugo, and wonderful to have your voice here on the call. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Lynn F.
Yes, great program. I'm actually out of town, but wouldn't miss one of your programs for anything. My question revolves around the FDA study that's being conducted about some of the possible side effects of bisphosphonates, particularly spontaneous femur fractures and osteonecrosis of the jaw. And I was hoping one of the physicians might be able to comment on that evaluation.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Rugo to address it, if you would take that, and I know that's a very important issue for many women in the breast cancer community. Dr. Rugo?
It's a really good question, and I think what happens a lot of times is we see reports, and then they sort of explode into very big issues. And when you go back and look at those reports, they're extremely rare. For example, I think everybody, you know, the things that weren't really true, like antiperspirants caused breast cancer, or, for example, when I was a child, coffee caused cancer of the pancreas. I think I was actually a young adult. And those kinds of things that come out based on, you know, in those situations, animal models. Well, so now what happens when we get these kinds of toxicity reports like spontaneous femur fractures? Well, I think we want to first understand, is it kind of like the Vioxx picture where there is really an increase in a, not huge, but an increase in a real toxicity that ended up taking that drug off the market? Or is it something that's extremely rare? And it actually falls into the second category, this spontaneous femur fracture. There was this famous report of a woman who had been on a bisphosphonate for many, many years, more than 10 years. He was public transportation in New York and had a fall and had this sort of linear fracture, a horizontal fracture of her femur. So that brought up a lot of concern about this. Huge databases were looked at, and this is extremely rare. It's actually a little bit unclear whether or not it's a true toxicity from the bisphosphonates or whether it has something to do with the bone problem that you took the bisphosphonate for. The real toxicities we do know about are osteonecrosis of the jaw. It's a rare toxicity. It appears to be associated with pulling teeth, as I think probably was discussed on the line already. And I think other than that, we really aren't seeing a lot of rare toxicities. Now, what happens when patients are on the potent IV bisphosphonates for many, many, many years, you know, say 20 years? We don't actually really know yet. So I think we're still in a process of learning this. And among bone experts, there's been a lot of discussion about maybe, you know, going on and off, for example, potent bisphosphonates over time. Certainly during the time course that we have patients on potent bisphosphonates with a cancer diagnosis and on aromatase inhibitors or in the metastatic setting, these don't appear to be concerns. I don't know if, Julie, you have any other thoughts on that.
I would just add that the question was asked about what if there are trials going on too, that there is a very large, many thousand person trial looking at this osteonecrosis of the jaw issue. It's called SWOG, S-O-7-O-2, and we're enrolling people when they start bisphosphonates for treatment of bone mets from any cancer, and then following out over time what the true incidence of this is, what the risk factors are, and then what the outcomes are. So we really, that is an FDA-mandated study that we're enrolling to and trying to get a better handle on that toxicity, which is clearly linked to the bisphosphonates and also the RANK ligand inhibitor denosumab.
Excellent. Wow, this is a wonderful team. Our next question, this is a fantastic team. Thank you. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Sharon B.
Hello, and thank you for the fine presentation. I want to ask Dr. Greenlow, would she please explain again about the breast cancer and how it breaks down the bone and how there's a vicious cycle going back and forth? And the second question is, what would be the best test to determine or to sign a diagnosis of metastasized breast cancer to the bone?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Greenlow?
Thanks. So this vicious cycle that I described happens when breast cancer cells get out into the blood and circulate. Sometimes they just circulate and die off and can't root anywhere, and so they don't cause metastases. But sometimes they can set up an environment, whether it be in the liver or the bone or the lungs or some other place, where they can, you know, kind of establish themselves and grow. So when they're flowing in the blood and they land in the bone marrow and in the bone, they can send out signals to the bone, and those signals say, break down the bone. And so they cause either directly or indirectly the osteoclasts, which are the cells in the bone that chew up bone, they cause them to start destroying a little bit of bone in the area where the breast cancer is. And as that bone is kind of being resorbed or destroyed in that area where the cancer cell is, some of there are some growth factors or signals that come out of the bone itself that feed the cancer cell and stimulate the cancer cell to grow. So the cancer cell creates a space in the bone, and then that space feeds the cancer cell, and that's part of the reason why breast cancer homes to the bone and can root in the bone so easily. So that's the vicious cycle. You then asked about what's the best test to diagnose metastasis, and the fact of the matter is that the data out there right now shows that there really aren't any tests that, you know, what we call intensive surveillance, that pick up a metastatic recurrence early enough to really impact survival. So the main things we do are we have regular clinic visits, we ask about symptoms, we follow up on symptoms or maybe just some routine basic lab values or things, but really we don't do intensive testing either of the blood or radiologically, because we just don't have data that any of those things really extend survival. So the key is symptoms and then following up on them, and then physical exam findings and following up on them in order to detect metastases.
I just wanted to make one comment about that last question.
Oh, sure.
Question,
absolutely.
If that's possible.
Yeah.
This is Hope Brugo. This is an interesting area because there has been some data looking at these cells in the bone marrow, and people refer to them as disseminated tumor cells, which I think is an unfortunate wording, DTCs. But you can find these cells in the bone marrow in about 30% of patients, and those patients may have a higher risk of recurrence. And so that's one of the areas that's being looked at in research studies to try and see if we could maybe target patients who are at higher risk of recurrence and use the presence or absence of those cells maybe as an indicator of early recurrence. And so we had done a prior study with zoledronate looking at those cells, and we're going to do a trial opening shortly with the RANK ligand drug, denosumab. And what's interesting is that what we're doing is checking a bone marrow aspiration after patients have completed their systemic therapy for early stage breast cancer, because we know that the cells, if they're still there afterwards, may increase the risk of recurrence. And so we want to target those patients who are at higher risk of recurrence, and they will receive denosumab.
Thank you. And we do have a question from one of our online participants, and I'm going to ask Dr. Rugo to address it. If the breast cancer metastasis is only to one bone, say L2, and it gets radiation, is there anything more that the patient has to do? And I think I'm going to ask Dr. Rugo to address this just in a general way, and then we hope you'll take this back to your treating healthcare physician. Dr. Rugo?
You know, this disease, which we call bone-only disease and limited bone-only disease, so recurrence that occurs in a single bone, you know, we treat usually in patients who have that kind of presentation, we treat with systemic hormone therapy, which can control the disease often for a very long period of time. Radiation is used to control pain, to reduce risk of fracture, but doesn't always have to be given depending on the situation, symptoms, and prior hormone treatment. But a single lesion in bone, we would just simply treat with a bone agent to keep the bone strong, although, again, you could wait on a bone agent like zoledronate or denosumab until there was additional disease in the future. But we often use a bone agent, particularly in the spine, to try and keep the bone as healthy as possible. I think there's been a trend towards limiting the extent of radiation to try and do, unfortunately, more expensive types of radiation like CyberKnife, where you radiate only the bone involved as opposed to the surrounding bones as well. But radiation is a tremendously effective tool to reduce pain and risk of other complications. And then hormone therapy. And recently we've had some very, very intriguing data that potentially we can extend and improve the response to hormone therapy by adding in a targeted agent called an mTOR inhibitor, a drug called everolimus that's approved for kidney cancer. And that data was presented in Europe and will be presented again in December in an updated form at our San Antonio breast cancer meeting that's all over the news. The trial is called Bolero 2, should you be interested in looking at it. And likely we'll have that drug approved in the United States next year for patients in this situation.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all presenters. You've just been really fantastic, just a wonderful team of presenters, a great team. I also want to thank all of you who've been listening and have asked such great questions. I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So that means that we definitely invite you to contact us at Cancer Care after the call if you have questions that you didn't get to ask. I know there are questions that you didn't get to ask. And you can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE. And the most important thing is actually that we don't want anyone to leave the call feeling that you are alone. We want you to know now that you're part of a community of support and that we are here truly to help you. And we are simply a phone call away, or if you prefer going to visit us online, whichever is more comfortable for you, but that we really are here to help you. And I want to thank you all for participating today. We have a number of other programs on breast cancer coming up this month, so stay tuned. And we expect you to be on some of the other programs as well. Thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.